It's 12 o'clock. You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. Time once again for an exciting edition of the Lunch Special.
I know my baby is gonna jump and shout. I know my baby girl is gonna jump and shout. When the train rolls up and I come walking out, hold out, baby, I'll be home one day. Hold out, baby, I'll be home one day. Please don't let nobody lead my little girl astray. Baby is gonna jump and shout. She's gonna jump and shout. I know my baby. I know my baby is gonna jump and shout. She's gonna jump and shout. When the train rolls up and her daddy comes walking out, out, baby, I'll be home one day. Hold out, baby, I'll be home one day. Please don't let nobody, don't let nobody lead my little girl astray. I love you, baby, I love you. Oh,
Joe Williams with the Count Basie Orchestra doing the comeback as picked by my guest today, William B. Gould IV. And William B. Gould IV is an emeritus professor at Stanford Law School and served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, from 1994 to 1998. He arbitrated the 1992 and 93 salary disputes between Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball Player Relations Committee. As NLRB chairman, he played a critical role in bringing the 1994-95 baseball strike to an end. Now he's come out with a book called Bargaining with Baseball. And in 1995, William B. Gould IV, then chairman of the National Labor Relations Board, cast a deciding vote to obtain the injunction that ended the longest strike in baseball history. 16 years of peaceful relations between baseball, labor, and management have followed, as well as an unprecedented prosperity in a relationship that had just endured 30 years of strikes and lockouts. This study, which clearly illustrates the practical impact of law on America's pastime, considers the 140-year sweep of labor-management relationships and conflict, exploring player-owner disputes, the development of free agency, the collective bargaining process, and the racial integration of baseball, among other topics. It concludes with a discussion of the steroids era, the problem with maintaining Jackie Robinson's legacy in the 21st century, and globalization. And welcome back to these airwaves, William B. Gould IV. I have to say that because there are six of you now. Well, six is on the scene.
Right, right. And, six is only 1 year old now.
And but you are the fourth, and that means there were three before you.
Yes, yes.
And Stanford Law, you're still with us. Still, you get this great new book, Bargaining with Baseball. And maybe not a lot of folks are, you know, remembering or aware of your contribution to that. Why don't you speak about this?
Well, on the labor front, of course, as you said, I was chairman of the labor board at the time of the longest and most tumultuous of the many disputes that existed between the players and the owners, and we became involved and got an injunction before convinced then-judge, now-justice, Sonia Sotomayor, to issue an injunction restraining the owners from making changes. The players came back to the field in the spring of 95. The owners accepted them, and they negotiated a comprehensive collective bargaining agreement between themselves, and they've done so without resort to strike or lockout ever since. And the revenues that they had at that time in 1995 were $1.7 billion. Today they're in excess of $7 billion. Everybody's doing very well. The players are doing well at the major league level, and the owners are doing well as also. And they seem to be, in contrast to the rest of the country, moving from one success to another economically.
One of the great things in your book is how you describe your journey to the point that you were picked by the president to be at the NLRB, and also your journey with baseball, because you had a kind of a, not a failed baseball career, but you know, you played baseball as a kid.
Yes.
And then got out of it, and it, you know, you didn't go that far in it.
Right.
But much later on in life, when you were a law professor, you started lecturing and discussing and talking and talking about baseball with colleagues and law and the relationship of the whole labor issue. And right, that led you to write a series of articles, and you basically became kind of one of the foremost authorities on law and the relationship of labor in baseball, didn't you?
Well, I had the good fortune to, you know, timing is everything, as they say, in baseball and life generally. And I had the good fortune to be there at the time that so many important issues that I had some expertise in were beginning to emerge. It was, in a way, as I've said to some people, a bit like serendipity, that here we had this labor issue, labor law, and labor law became the big issue in baseball. We've had, and regrettably, over the first 30 years, we had nothing but failure in terms of the ability of the parties to resolve their differences peaceably. But over these past 16 years, as I say, I think that the parties have done, both the players and owners have done well. Sometimes, really, in my view, at the expense of the public, sometimes so many decisions, as I outline in the book, are so focused on commerce that they sometimes are not sufficiently responsive to regular people who love the game. And I give just a few examples. We can give just a few examples. The unwillingness to televise any and have any World Series games or postseason games during the day, when kids who you know, are just becoming involved with the game are most likely to be able to see it, at least on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And of course, Fox Television dictates to baseball when these games are going to be played. And mm-hmm. Now, in the negotiations for the upcoming contract between the players and the owners, they're looking at postseason play, and they're talking about a new wild card. Why? Because, well, it's true that having one wild card puts the winners of the divisions at something of an unfair disadvantage, because they have done well, better than the team that's a wild card. So the idea is to how to disadvantage the wild card. Well, they're moving towards a system where they'll create another wild card. And of course, the reason they want to create another wild card is because that means more postseason games, more television, more revenue, and more money in everybody's pocket. So, and this, of course, has been a driving theme of baseball, even if we look at the racial integration of the game. I mean, Branch Rickey saw that there was a market out there, that and I think it's a good thing. He deserves praise for it in some measure, but he saw that, you know, that you get black people into the parks as well, and he could tap revenues that weren't there previously. And if you look at most of the decisions that have been made, they're driven by that. Sometimes they produce good results, sometimes not so good.
Did they used to have an unofficial World Series between the Negro Leagues and the White League?
They did. Not the White League. They had many exhibition
games. Major
games.
League Baseball.
Black and white played together in exhibition games.
They never kept records of those games, did they?
No.
In fact, rumor has it that the Negro Leagues won a lot of those games.
Well, and rumor has it also that Satchel Paige dominated Babe Ruth. Again, there are no records of that.
Gee, what a
Well, he was an amazing pitcher. I saw him when he first came up in 1948. My mother and I were sitting on the left field stands in Yankee Stadium and saw him throw his great hesitation pitch to the Yankees, and he was very successful then in his early 40s, or he was reputed to be in his early 40s. We don't really know what his age was.
Where did you see him?
In Yankee Stadium.
Oh, my
then, and, you know, before the days of fire regulations, there were close to 80,000
80,000
fans in there, and hot as the dickens. And we saw my mother, so patient with me as my father was, indulging this passion that I had for baseball. We saw two games that day, and saw more than our fill of baseball, but not enough for me.
These must be great memories, and this is what helped get this book to Bargaining with Baseball by William B. Gould IV. He's our guest for the hour, and you're going to have your first book event tomorrow night at Books Incorporated in Mountain View on Castro Street at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
And then you're doing two more events next week, the Tuesday the 4th, you're going to be over at Cal. Ooh, Cal, the enemy. But the next night, you're going to be at Sanford Bookstore, so that kind of makes up for it.
Yes.
So next week, you'll be at Cal Tuesday at the Institute for Labor and Employment Relations. Is that inside the law school?
No, that's a separate entity. Deal? They're on Channing Street in Berkeley.
Okay, so yeah. Not right on campus?
No, well, it's on, well, I don't know technically whether that's, maybe that's not part of the campus. It's certainly right near the university.
Okay, so the Institute for Labor and Employment Relations, that's next Tuesday at 5:30. And then you'll be here on campus at the Stanford Bookstore next Wednesday, the 5th of October at 5:30.
Yes.
So people can catch you in any of those three spots. And we'll put up links to all that on our website as well. William B. Gould, should we play another piece of music?
Great.
And this looks like it's going to be the Modern Jazz Quartet with Ralph's Blues. And you want to set this up at all? You always bring great records when you come on the show.
Well, this really takes me back. I first heard the MJQ right around this time, 1954, 55.
Oh, you're going back now, man.
And they were just, I can see them now on the stage, dressed to the nines. They were so exquisite.
And, where'd you see them?
In Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
they were just dressed to the nines and played exquisitely.
Let's check him out. Now here's Ralph's Blues with the MJQ. Talk over this beautiful music. Forgive us, but I'm here with a very important guest today, William B. Gould IV, Stanford Law Professor Emeritus. That means you're retired. You're not really retired, though, because you wrote this book. You got a brand new book called Bargaining with Baseball. You're going to be at the Stanford Bookstore next Wednesday at 5:30. Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. And really, well, from our last segment talking, you might have saved baseball. You might have. From your actions back during the strike in 94, 95, you might have saved baseball.
Well, yeah. Of course, you know, the Red Sox announcers are joking a bit about the fact that it took a Yankee fan, Justice Sotomayor, and me, a Red Sox fan, to get together and to do this. She delivered the injunction, which we requested of her.
Yeah, and you want to read some from the book, some passages.
A great opinion that she, a passage from an opinion that she wrote that really puts you in mind of the beauty of the game. She said in her opinion, "The often leisurely game of baseball is filled with so many small moments which catch a fan's breath. There is, for instance, that wonderful second when you see an outfielder backpedaling and jumping up to the wall, and time stops for an instant as he jumps up and you finally figure out whether it is a home run, a double, or a single off the wall, or an out. More than a quarter of a century before that 1995 baseball case, on a typically warm and humid evening in Washington, D.C. Stadium, later RFK, Red Sox lefty Dick Ellsworth was on the hill against the hometown Washington Senators and was clearly tiring in the late innings of that 1968 summer night. But manager Dick Williams had no one in the bullpen effective enough to relieve Ellsworth, and thus stayed with him as Hank Aaron stepped in at the plate with the Senators trailing 2-1 with two on and two out in the bottom of the ninth. Aaron hit a prodigiously long shot to deep left center, which Reggie Smith, the Sox center fielder, somehow beautifully tracked down and raced to the wall for, and leaped high against the fence. As he descended to the center field grass, there was that precious moment of which Judge Sotomayor spoke. It was similar to Manny Ramirez's spectacular grab in the September 04 Yankee Stadium series of a ball which he plucked out of the left field stands after it had been hit off the bat of the Yankee second baseman who circled the bases thinking he had hit a home run. But in Reggie Smith's descent to terra firma, if the ball was over the fence, the Senators had won the game by two runs on a walk-off, or what the Japanese call a sayonara home run. And if it was caught, the game was over with, the Red Sox the victors. Only when the Sox bullpen erupted, racing down the left field line and onto the field to greet Smith as he held the ball high, was the result apparent. Smith had made a spectacular grab. This was then that breathless, inescapable moment of which Justice Sotomayor spoke.
William B. Gould IV, reading from his current book, Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. And he knows of what he speaks because he was there and helped settle the strike in 94 and 95. This must really just make you feel great to culminate your life's work, part of your life's work, because you were a law professor in all the sense, but to be able to take your passion for baseball and put it into this book.
Well, it does make me feel good and be able to bring together these two different disciplines, which in many ways I think are related to one another. Baseball is a very complex game, a very nuanced game, probably more nuanced than any game that I can think of. I think it is, some say, call it God's game, and it's a perfect game, and it's something that extols both individuality, the confrontation between the pitcher and the batter, and it also involves intricate team play, mm-hmm. laying down a bunt, sacrificing, moving runners across, hitting the ball in a particular place, which will make a runner advance, and setting up a defense, positioning the players. All of this you have to, is not too susceptible to observation through television. You really have to see it in the moment and be there, and it's a great game. So I'm was very excited about bringing these two worlds together, the world of law and also the world of baseball.
Mm-hmm. Little side note, have you seen the new movie Moneyball yet with Brad Pitt?
I haven't
Pitt?
Seen it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've read the book, of course, and it's an interesting book. I think that the Oakland A's deserve a lot of credit, primarily because they had a lot of people on their staff, and I think still do, who have good baseball acumen, mm-hmm. Who can really observe and make judgments about baseball players in a way which many teams can't. I think that the author of the book exaggerates some of the features like on-base percentage. He thinks that that's a new idea that Billy Beane focused on. We were talking about on-base percentage when we were kids, comparing Williams to Cobb.
Really?
These were the players who were good, not only because they could hit, but because they could get on base. They knew how to take walks. And this is not new. This is not rocket science. And but Michael Lewis, who I think is a little new to baseball, thought that it was. But this doesn't detract from the great innovations that were made by Billy Beane. These innovations haven't been destroyed because they were stolen by other teams. That's not why the A's are suffering today, as so many are saying around here. The Tampa Bay Rays, who are scurrying after my Boston Red Sox and making life so difficult for us, have learned many of the things that Beane learned and really performed very effectively in recent years with good players because they have people on the staff with good judgment.
I never realized, and I saw this on camera recently, that other teams will send scouts to watch their opponents play different games, and these scouts will sit there and do specific tasks, and there'll be two or three of them in the stands for a team,
right?
And they'll be taking notes on every kind of different thing that team does and how they do it, and like you said, on base percentage and everything.
Yes,
and
yes.
It really is a game of strategy, isn't it?
It is a game of strategy, and it's a game that involves personal observation. Moneyball says, Beane developed the idea that fielding averages are not important. Nonsense. Again, from the 1940s onward, we knew that Phil Rizzuto had an inferior fielding percentage compared to Vern Stevens of the Red Sox. Uh-huh. The reason his statistics were inferior was that he could get to a lot of balls, and he had the potential for making more errors than Stevens. Range, which is now being focused upon, particularly by the general manager of the Seattle Mariners, is quite critical.
Let me read a quote from the back of the book. If Major League Baseball ever awarded a Nobel Peace Prize, it should go to Bill Gould for effectively ending baseball's nuclear war, the strike of 94-95. During his tenure at the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, as chairman, in his new book, the distinguished law professor has chronicled the game's history of labor and racial relations from his unique perspective. That's Joe Castiglione, broadcaster for the Boston Red Sox. That's got to really make you feel good, huh?
Well, it does. Joe is it's high praise, and I'm grateful for that comment.
Definitely. William B. Gould IV. Did you have something else you wanted to read from the book?
Well, there are a couple of things I suppose I wanted to read from the book. One was just talking about how I became involved with the game in the summer of 1946 when I started playing sandlot ball with a bunch of my buddies. As you point out, my career came to a premature end, and I was a failure on the field because at the age of 14, I had a 3-2 count on me with this guy who was a left-handed pitcher who was throwing me sliders and cutting the corner, and these were called strikes, and I figured he's going to, on the 3-2 count, he's going to throw another one of these things, and I'm going to swing at it because the umpire called it a strike. And instead, he comes in with a high fastball above my, really above my head, and I swing at it wildly, and the coach looks at me and says, that's the end. He cut me. So that was the end of my baseball career. And but we had played before that in a very unsupervised way. I say, you know, I talk about this sweet summer of Sandlot baseball in 1946. Virtually every day at Long Branch, New Jersey's Station Field, near the Long Branch, New York Long Branch Railroad tracks in New Jersey on the Jersey Shore. Every day after fourth grade. Just the age now of my grandson, who I talk about in this book also.
That's the sixth, right?
That's Joey. Who's 10 years old. Every day after fourth grade had let out that June, our mothers packed our lunches for us before we jumped on our bikes to pedal towards the station field. No uniforms, no umpires or adult supervision. Sometimes the catcher, always without equipment, was on one's own team, standing far behind home plate as he took the pitch on one bounce. Sometimes we played with our pants half rolled up, as they were, in order to avoid getting caught in the bicycle chains. Only baseball, all morning and afternoon, with makeshift bases established where the grass had worn thin, without any exact rule of measurement from base to base, or from an unelevated pitching mound and home plate. We knew nothing about the proper pitching distance of 60 and 6 that had been designated ever since 1893. And with no umpires, like the 19th century rules, which at one time did not contemplate call strikes and even allowed a batter to call for a high or low pitch, we didn't follow that rule, only peer pressure could induce one to swing at a pitch that was not precisely to a young hitter's liking. Under these circumstances, the pitcher would frequently groove one to attempt to tempt an otherwise reticent hitter who was waiting for that perfect pitch, and batting averages would soar under those circumstances to 700 and above, and mine did. So I was, and we loved it. We played every day, all day, morning and afternoon. The hotter it got, the better I liked it.
These have to be amazing memories for you, huh?
Oh, very, very important memories, and they kind of have put the game in my bones, so to speak. But although in the 1950s, in the face of Yankee hegemony and the fact that I became, at that point, very much interested in reading everything I could get my hands on in the area of history and politics and literature, I began to push baseball to the background. And my father, who had thought that I was kind of out of balance in the 40s, said, you know, you're really spending too much time with this game, and then began to say to me, hey, whatever became of baseball? And so eventually I returned with more enthusiasm than ever.
You came back with a vengeance. The new book is Bargaining with Baseball. It's by William Gould IV, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. Two things I want to touch on. You're touching on the racial integration factor in baseball. And also, HBO came out with a great documentary a few months back, and I got to watch, and I never knew this story about Kirk Flood. And about the fact that he was the first one that stepped out of the system and said, this is before collective, before free agency. And he was the first one that said, no, I'm not going to be traded. I'm staying here. And, you know, you're not going to do that. And he tried to sue, and it ruined his entire career. And he really never did recover to get back into baseball. He played a couple more years, but it kind of destroyed him. But he became the kind of John Brown, if you will, of the movement to start free agency. Just go ahead and speak about that a little bit.
Well, Kurt Flood was the first, was the real pioneer. He tried to get the Supreme Court to re-examine the federal baseball decision of 1922, which had held in a decision authored by Justice Holmes that baseball was not a business within interstate commerce, within the meaning of the antitrust law and the Constitution. And clearly that decision was flawed. And the Supreme Court in 1972 in the Flood case said as much, but they adhered to a doctrine which we lawyers call stare decisis. That is to say that we will follow precedent even though we don't agree with the precedent. And if somebody wants to change it, well, the Congress is always free to change it at some point in the future. So Flood lost by a vote of 5-3 in the Supreme Court in 1972. And he, I think, as the years went on, was increasingly recognized as a pioneer. He inspired others to try a different approach to free agency. And the Mr. Messersmith, Andy Messersmith of the Dodgers, Dave McNally, the grandfather of one of the Stanford football players here, McNally, they filed the grievances under the collective bargaining agreement, and they got a ruling from the arbitrator saying that once a so-called option year had been played out, if there was no new contract, then the players, notwithstanding the custom of a reserve rule, locking in a player to one club for life, were free agents. And that, of course, changed the face of baseball. And interestingly enough, although the owners were always afraid that the house would burn down if players were free to go wherever they wanted, and that fans would lose interest in teams because the players they supported were going elsewhere. The fans didn't seem to be bothered by these blockbuster trades when the clubs were shifting players from team to team. Mm-hmm. They thought that this would change everything. Well, the game has become more competitive and more prosperous in the process. You know, today, the owners take credit for collective bargaining changes that they've made, revenue sharing, the luxury tax, as being the vehicle for creating more competition. You know, I have a cartoon in the book where a guy has a shirt on saying Obama, hope, change, and he says, listen, you know, I thought that there was going to be all this hope and change once I voted for President Obama, but I see that everything is exactly, and we thought we were going to take on the New York moneyed interest, and then he opens the paper, Yankees win World Series. He said, I see that everything is the same. Well, the Yankees have only won one World Series in the 21st century, and although they're always in the picture in the postseason and are there again this year, rarely get to the supreme, the apex of the whole system. They rarely win the World Championship. The game is more competitive. The top payroll team rarely comes in first. The Yankees, of course, are always the top payroll team. My team, the Red Sox, emulates them, but can never quite get to their stature.
William B. Gould IV. He's going to be at Stanford Bookstore next Wednesday, the 5th of October at 5:30. You can catch him there. You can catch him tomorrow night in Mountain View on Castro Street at Books Incorporated. It might be Books Inc. Mountain View, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. And, William, let's talk about integration into baseball. And you really touch on that in the book. And why don't you go ahead and expound on that a little bit? Because sure, a lot of people heard the Jackie Robinson story and Larry Doby, and, you know, along came Willie Mays and everything else. And well, just go ahead and speak on that.
Yeah, well, I think that the fact that Robinson and Doby came along in the spring and summer of 1947, terribly important event in race relations history in the United States, you know, antedates President Truman's desegregation of the armed forces, antedates the Supreme Court 1954 ruling Brown against Board of Education, separate but equal in public education, is unconstitutional.
It was in 48, right? When Robinson got in?
47. Jackie Robinson came in April 15, 1947. He had played the previous year with the Montreal Royals, the farm team of the Dodgers, and then Doby came up a couple of months later, taken directly from the Negro League, and played for the Cleveland Indians. I saw him that first summer, and also in 1948, and I've never seen a guy swing so hard. he had a very difficult time. You know, it's hard for us to, any of us, to imagine what those men endured in the way of, well, let us be frank about it, from the public, from teammates, from managers, outright racism. And I always remember that in 1947, the Sporting News said that when Dan Bankhead, the second black player, was called up for the minors to the Dodgers, the Sporting News said, this is a great thing because now Robinson will have someone to room with. You know, the idea being taken as a given that, well, he couldn't room with white players.
Right.
And, of course, the quota, the limitation on black players was kept in place until well into the 1960s, the early 70s, where only the very top guys, this is why, you know, we know about Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, these are the superstars.
Mm-hmm.
Blacks outhit whites 290 to 260 in those years. So you didn't get the utility infielders. You didn't get the 230 hitters who can make most teams, particularly in those years. You could have guys who could hit 220, 230, but were good with the glove. No blacks were in those positions at all. We began to make some strides forward. Eventually, we get a black manager, Frank Robinson, in 1975. There was no black manager until 1975. Robinson never even got an offer. Now, today, we've retrogressed in major respects, at least particularly on the field. We have fewer black players. We do have more black Latin players, but we have fewer black American players than has ever been the case. We've really moved to new lows in that regard. And this is why I have a chapter called The Growing Importance of Race in Baseball. Baseball, belatedly, as they do with so many issues, belatedly is now focusing upon this and trying to do something about it. But I think that there are a lot of institutional problems with making big breakthroughs in this area.
So baseball hasn't really shaken its racist past, has it?
It has not. Baseball has, at least in with regard to on the field playing, and it's there are some black managers, there are some Latin managers. There are very few, I think one or two, black third base coaches, which is the ladder up to being a manager. You know, from being a third base coach, this is the thinking man's position on the field.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make a lot of tough decisions. And from there, you go to being a bench coach, to kind of being an assistant manager. DeMarlo Hale of the Red Sox is now a bench coach there and presumably in line to be a manager, we hope, in the near foreseeable future. But we have a long way to go. And despite the fact that baseball has done some good things, the civil rights games, more personnel in the front office, but not in the key positions, generally speaking, only Kenny Williams, Chicago White Sox, a Stanford graduate, is a black general manager in Major League Baseball.
Hmm.
We have a long way to go.
It's funny, too, because if you trace it back, if inner-city youth, which are usually youth of color, don't have the right tools, if they don't have the right school, you know, if they don't have sports in their school, then they don't get that chance to play like you did as a kid and get that real familiar. And then once, you know, once you get into your teens, if you don't have that baseball foundation and grew up with it, you're probably not going to get into it at all.
Right. Well, baseball's been saying for years that, oh, the young black players who are talented, athletic, go into football and basketball. Well, they do because, A, there are the resources available at the local level, and B, there are the college scholarships. You know, the NCAA provides for scholarships for 80 full scholarships for 80 plus players in football. Baseball has no full scholarships.
Why is that?
Because baseball doesn't bring in revenue.
Oh.
Football is king. The universities are making a lot of money out of football, and so they bring in the revenue. They provide for the scholarships, and that steers a disproportionate number of black youngsters who are talented in both games away from baseball into football. And you see that right here at Stanford, there are a large number of black players on the football team. We have a few black players on the baseball team now. There have been years in the past where there have been one or none.
Wow.
Today we have a few, but we're overcoming this tremendous handicap, and that means in an age where more players at the professional ranks are recruited from college, you have a smaller pool going into the professional ranks.
So maybe America hasn't shaken off its racist past.
Well, I think that there are a lot of practices that produce racial exclusion, this is one of them.
The book, Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. I know you did bring some great music, and I know you wanted to get some on, and we are running short on time. We can just, I guess, save one for the last, because the conversation is just too good now. But, you know, why don't we make this part one? Can we do this?
Sure.
Can you come? Because you live close by, right?
Yes, sure.
Would you come back?
Oh, I'd love to.
Let's do this, because this book is too deep, and you're too deep to... An hour doesn't get it, you know what I mean? We're just getting warmed up here.
Have book will travel.
That's right, and you're available for book events. If anybody listening wanted to get a hold of you for a book event at a store or a house event, how could they do that? You got a webpage or an email address?
Yes, I think the law school has... on its homepage, something up about the events.
Okay, Stanford Law.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So just get on Stanford Law page, and they can get a hold of you that way.
I think. Yeah. You're
okay.
Right.
William B. Gould IV is the author of the book, and our guest today for the hour. And so we pretty much touched. One of the questions I was going to ask is what's the state of baseball today? And we pretty much touched on that because it is well. Off mic, I asked you about Yankee Stadium. You know, the Steinbrenner family got a chance to build a new stadium with some public money, I think, right? It wasn't.
Yes.
Because the stadium out here, our stadium, Pac Bell, that was privately financed.
It's very unusual. It's unusual to get a stadium financed privately, although the taxpayers do pay something because of infrastructure and police and security associated with. Stadium, but it's very unusual for a stadium to stand on its own, as was done here in San Francisco. It's a great tribute to the people who staved off the move of the Giants to Tampa Bay,
Lord, right.
That was many years ago in the early 90s. And but unfortunately, a lot of public money is tapped into, and the public doesn't always... benefit from those monies. The cost of tickets, we have a little chart on that in the book, what it costs for a family to go to a game. We were talking about the fact that some of these tickets in Yankee Stadium are $250. Some of them are much more than that. The Red Sox have the Red Sox average ticket this year is in excess of $60. So that's a pretty expensive ticket. One of the things that we always thought that baseball had going for it was that more games, tickets are cheaper compared to football and basketball, which are absolutely obscene, and that regular people can see these games. That's getting less true. You take a look at the crowds at AT&T. This is a very affluent, middle-class, professional crowd.
Right.
Over at the Coliseum, the Oakland Coliseum, there are more working people who go to those games, and they have less money, and the tickets are lower. The crowds are smaller. It's kind of a circular problem that Oakland has suffered from for some time.
Yeah. And Yankee Stadium being a perfect example, even middle class folks can't afford $250 to go to a ball game.
Right.
That's
right.
Insane.
Yes.
A beer must be $25.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the beer, because of course that's another thing. The everything that you buy inside the park
is super inflated.
Marked up and.
Bill, do you think it's just greed? Is it that the owners just want to keep making more and more and more? I mean, I guess when you become a corporation, you're supposed to grow a certain percent every year, right? And if you don't, then you're not doing what you're supposed to do. That's the capitalist creed, right?
Well, I think that money is the name of the game. It's always been money that is the name of the game. You know, the idea was in the 19th century. You know, although some of the leagues resisted this, draw a crowd, get them into a confined area, and sell them beer. One of the things I talk about in the book are the problems with violence in the game. We've had some experience with this in Oakland, and of course this year with this terrible, tragic situation in Los Angeles. Too much booze. At these games, and because you know the idea is to sell booze. You know the Red Sox had an incident a few years ago involving Gary Sheffield, who was then with the Yankees, where some guys just reached out of the stands and poured beer on him, and the Red Sox grabbed these guys and banned them from the not only criminally prosecuted them, but banned them from the stadium. But of course, the news reporters noted. The next night, the volume of alcohol being sold was greater than ever.
Oh gosh! How about the case of the before we wind up here? How about the case of the Dodgers? Now the Dodgers got a new owner, and yes. he seemed to leverage the team bank account, and all of a sudden they were broke. And then he was going through a divorce, and so the team suffered through all this, and therefore the fans too, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Then they got taken over by Major League Baseball, right? They came in and took them over. And has that been settled yet?
It hasn't been settled. The team is the McCourt, the owner of the Dodgers, is still litigating against the Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball has been aggressive, I think, with some justification in trying to put that stadium into proper hands, that team into proper hands. Somebody who will be concerned with promoting the team. It's a very good team. You know, they have some good players.
Yeah.
When you see the quality of the team out there, but they're in turmoil because of what the owner has done. The Mets have a big problem. Their owners are were involved with Bernie Madoff, and they're in litigation now. They may have to sell their team also, because of the amount of money that they may be charged by the victims of Madoff's shenanigans.
They were getting the payoff for Madoff.
Well, they did get money from Madoff, which
had been stolen from somebody else.
Maintained they should have known about Madoff. Now, how that will play out, we don't know at this point. But that, if indeed the courts hold that they are that they should have exercised due diligence and didn't with Madoff, they may wind up being in hock for billions and have to unload the team as a result of it.
Crazy stuff. The guest for the hour has been William B. Gould. His new book, Bargaining with Baseball, he's a professor of law emeritus here at Stanford. He was chairman of the NLRB during the 1994-95 baseball strike, possibly saved baseball for the future, but the future's still looking a little sketchy, isn't it, Bill?
Well, I think baseball is better off than some of the other sports. Baseball is now negotiating a new collective bargaining agreement. They probably have a better shot at doing this peaceably for the coming season than basketball, for instance, which is in a good deal of turmoil. The players have been locked out by the owners. Baseball has a number of things on the table. The whole question of whether there'll be an international draft. The owners are concerned about all these players leaving Cuba as soon as the Castro brothers go, who are very talented and who will be able to bid up their services, bid up the price for their services with a number of teams. They want to relegate them to one team. There are problems relating to the draft. The owners feel that they're paying too much money for some of the young kids who come right out of Stanford, for instance. They paid Joe Borchard here, the outfielder from Stanford, $5 million. And so they want to control that. And there may be other changes in the drafting system. HGH, you know, we talked about steroids. I have a whole chapter on steroids in the book. Mm-hmm. But one of the points is that although we now have testing for steroids, which seems to be gradually improving, there are still a lot of imperfections. There's not enough out-of-season testing. Roger Clemens, I think, learned how to work that system very well when he was in baseball. There's no testing for HGH at all. And the players seem somewhat resistant to the idea of testing football. Now that you have the members of Congress writing the NFL and the Players Association saying, hey, what are you going to do about this? Well, unless baseball does something, they're going to be writing them too. Don't forget that if it hadn't been for Lance Williams here with the San Francisco Chronicle and Mark Fanaro, and then the congressman who wanted to preen in front of the television cameras as they excoriated baseball, hadn't been for those two factors, you know, we might be going on right today with Bud Selig saying, well, you know, there really isn't much of a problem here. We've got a good system intact. So we might be seeing a replay of what happened in with regard to steroids, with regard to HGH. So all these issues and more, revenue sharing, are on the table in collective bargaining now. Some of the teams, like the Red Sox, for instance, feel that they're paying too much money to teams like the A's and the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Kansas City Royals, who don't do anything with those monies. Why should we be paying, say the owners of the Red Sox, this kind of money? So all these things will be on the bargaining table, and but I think on balance we have a better chance for a peaceable resolution of these differences than we do in basketball and than we did in football, and that we might in 2012 in hockey.
You can catch him tomorrow night in Mountain View at Books, Inc. on Castro at 7 p.m. And next Wednesday, October 5th, a week from Wednesday, October 5th, at the Stanford Bookstore at 5:30. William B. Gould, thank you so much for being our guest today. And let's make this part one. Let's come back for part two real soon, okay?
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Stand by for Holt Sorensen and the Electronic Groove.